This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson. Tonight, use your imagination. China's ambassador to Australia warns Beijing will use all necessary means to reunify with Taiwan. Also, opposition leader Peter Dutton declines an invitation to the government's keynote jobs summit, but his junior coalition partner could have a seat at the table. And suburban chook lovers urged to be on alert. A new study finds dangerous levels of lead in backyard eggs.
There's a distinct possibility that if we're consuming lots of eggs from a location where there's high levels of lead in the soil, there is a potential risk of harm that they'd be consuming too much lead.
Thanks for your company. China's ambassador to Australia has warned it's willing to use all necessary means to reunify Taiwan with China, saying that there's no room for compromise when it comes to the country's sovereignty. In a speech at the National Press Club in Canberra, Xiao Xian blamed the United States for undermining the peace and stability of the Taiwan Strait and warned Australia that it should handle the Taiwan question with caution. Nell Whitehead begins our coverage.
For 30 minutes in Canberra, the Chinese ambassador, Xiao Xian, struck a friendly note, saying there was a chance to reset the bilateral relationship under Australia's new Labour government. But when it came to questions about Taiwan, the self-governing island which China claims, he had a less compromising message.
When necessary, when compelled, we are ready to use all necessary means. As to what does it mean by all necessary means, you can use your imagination. The 1.4 billion Chinese people are absolutely determined to protect our sovereignty, territory and integrity. We will never allow Taiwan to be separated from China.
Tensions have been rocketing in the Taiwan Strait since the US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island on August the 2nd. China launched 4 days of military drills, its largest ever around Taiwan, which was supposed to end on Sunday. But they've now been extended without an end date, raising fears about drawn-out hostilities. Here's what the ambassador had to say about China's military preparations.
Speaker Pelosi insisted on visiting Taiwan region in disregard of China's strong opposition, making it clear to the world it was the U.S. side who first took provocative actions to change and undermine the status quo. China is compelled to take countermeasures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Chinese jets and warships have moved closer than ever to Taiwan. And today, Beijing published its first white paper on the dispute with Taipei in 2 decades. It says that China will not renounce the use of force and reserves the option to take all necessary measures, reinforcing fears in Canberra and Washington that Beijing will launch an invasion.
I'd rather not use the word invasion when we talk about China and Taiwan. Taiwan is not an independent state. Taiwan is a province of the People's Republic of China. It's an issue of reunification and an issue of Taiwan coming back to the motherland. The people in the mainland, people in Taiwan, are Chinese. We are both Chinese. And the Taiwanese are compatriots of China. And the least thing we're ready to do is to use force. And that is one of the reasons why China has been so patient. We are waiting for a peaceful unification. But we can never rule out our option to use other means.
In Taiwan, support for unification is at historic lows. Polling shows that most of the island's 23 million people want to maintain the status quo. Only 1.3% want unification with China as soon as possible, though the ambassador claims those polls are misleading.
And the future of Taiwan will be decided by 1.4 billion Chinese people. And at the same time, I believe that the majority of the people in Taiwan believe they're Chinese. They believe Taiwan is part of China, and Taiwan is a province of China. Therefore, reunification.
Once Taiwan is reunited with the mainland, he says, in so many words, that China would launch a re-education program for Taiwan's population.
My personal understanding is that once Taiwan is reunited, coming back to the motherland, there might be a process for the people in Taiwan to have a correct understanding of China.
Beijing objects to all foreign shows of support for Taiwan and to public condemnations of its military build-up. And in Canberra today, the ambassador had thinly veiled warnings for Australia.
We hope that Australian side could take China-Australia relations with serious attitude. Take the One China principle seriously. Handle the Taiwan question with caution.
High-level ministerial meetings between Australia and China have resumed since the Labour government was elected. But it's tone, not policy, that shifted. And before the ambassador spoke today, Australia's acting Prime Minister, Richard Marles, admitted that might not be enough.
If engaging in a more respectful diplomatic way takes us some way down a path, it does. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. We can only control our end of this equation, but we will always be speaking up for the national interest.
That's the acting Prime Minister Richard Marles ending Nell Whitehead's report. So what did this speech reveal about China's intentions in regards to Taiwan and in terms of relations with Australia and the world? Well, Stan Grant's a former China correspondent and now host of the China Tonight program on ABC, and he joined me earlier. Stan, in the prepared remarks, the ambassador spoke somewhat optimistically of a reset in relations between Australia and China, but when he faced questions from the press, the conversation seemed to take on a harder edge, didn't it?
It certainly did. I mean, look, Chao Chan is a very skilled ambassador. He's served in other posts, and he was clearly sent here with the prospect of potentially a reset in the relationship between Australia and China, and particularly since the change of government. We've seen signs of that, haven't we, with the meetings between the Chinese foreign minister and Penny Wong, our foreign minister. But you're right to identify that the questions revealed a much harder line. Gone was the talk of what we share together and respecting each other's sovereignty. And what we heard were red lines, no compromise over Taiwan. Leave it up to your imagination as to what we would do. Don't call it an invasion. Taiwan is part of China. You must respect the One China policy. It was a much harder line about Chinese sovereignty and respecting China's place in the world. And that's where we land right now, on the horns of this dilemma. How do we deal with a much more powerful, much more economically powerful, militarily powerful and assertive China?
Just to unpick a couple of those on the question of reunifying Taiwan, as you say, he said he preferred not to use the word invasion, but said China was ready to use all necessary means to make that reunification happen. And we could use our imagination as to what that means. I mean, diplomatic language, but it seemed to have a somewhat sinister edge.
It means conflict. That's what it means. And China has always reserved the right to use that force. Xi Jinping has reiterated that he would use force if necessary to reunify Taiwan. The difference now is that China is increasingly in a position to be able to assert that force in a way that it wasn't before. It has been building its military. It seeks military parity with the United States within the next 5 years. We've seen an example of that over the past couple of weeks with this ramping up of military exercises, war games to intimidate Taiwan after Nancy Pelosi's visit. So he's repeating what has been a long-standing Chinese line about the use of force, all means necessary. China now has the capacity to be able to deliver on that.
He also spoke, as some identified, he didn't use these words, but some claimed he was talking of the re-education of the people of Taiwan. What he actually said was that there could be a process for people in Taiwan to have a correct understanding of China. What did you read from that?
Well, the correct understanding of China is an obedience to the Chinese Communist Party. It's that simple, that the Chinese Communist Party has long run a narrative that It is the Communist Party that has avenged the 100 years of humiliation. It is built around a sense of vengeance or resentment. What it sees is the exploitation and abuse and hostility of foreign powers, dating back to the Opium Wars of the mid-19th century, that Taiwanese people must respect the power of the Chinese Communist Party, must respect the laws of the Chinese Communist Party. It is what we have seen elsewhere in Xinjiang with the so-called re-education there, which have been described as a genocide with these things that are akin to concentration camps. We've seen in Hong Kong a similar approach there with a crackdown on democracy. It is saying very specifically that there is one way of seeing China, and there is the Chinese Communist Party at the centre of everything that China does.
And just briefly, where does this speech leave Australia's relationship with China?
Look, the door is ajar if you want to see this optimistically. One of the things that Chao Chen pointed out is that China, for all of the belligerence of recent times and the increasing tensions with other world powers, is a part of a global order. It is a signatory to the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, the United Nations. It's a permanent five Security Council member. It contributes to global peacekeeping operations. It has significant trade ties with most of the world. It's the biggest engine of economic growth. There have been green shoots of some reset with Australia. That's the optimistic view. The other view, of course, is that once again we have seen that if pushed into a corner, there are these red lines that China will act upon. At the end of the day, China wants to assert itself, and it will assert itself by force if necessary, and Taiwan remains absolutely a flashpoint.
Stan Grant, thank you.
Thank you, David.
That's the host of the ABC's China Tonight program, Stan Grant. Well, Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers has pushed back against claims an upcoming jobs summit will be an inconsequential talk fest. Opposition leader Peter Dutton declined an invitation to the event, which he labelled as nothing more than a stunt. But not all in the coalition are as sceptical. Nationals leader David Littleproud has now accepted an invitation to go. Oliver Gordon has been taking a look.
It's being touted as a crucial meeting between business, government and unions, but there'll be one notable absence at next month's Jobs Summit.
We're not going to support stunts.
Opposition leader Peter Dutton says within hours of declining his invite to the event, it was in the papers.
The fact that Jim Chalmers wrote to me and then within a couple of hours dropped that letter to the Australian newspaper demonstrates it was nothing more than a stunt.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers has responded to those claims.
And of course there are no secret invitations to a public forum.
He says the opposition leader's invitation has been treated like anyone else's.
We invited him some point after that in the same way that we will make it clear down the track who else has been invited and accepted. You know, we will make that information publicly known. I mean, Peter Dutton is always looking for an excuse to trash consensus and to trash the collaborative efforts that everybody else is engaged in.
The Liberal Party has ruled out any of its MPs attending next month's Jobs Summit, but the junior coalition partner is taking a different approach. Nationals leader David Littleproud wants to come, and he has ideas for rural and regional Australia.
I think it's time for the next generation of migrants to come to regional Australia to fill the skills gaps, but also to be part of agriculture and broader society to take us to the next level.
Peter Dutton has refused his invitation, but you're saying you'd like a seat at the table. Is that significant of a difference in opinion with you two with regards to this new idea of constructive government?
Well, we're two different parties, and while we're in coalition, diversity within a coalition is a good thing. And Peter represents a different constituency to me. And while I think this is more of a political show than it is about substance, I mean, many of these issues we already know. And if you're the government, you just get on with the job. But I think this is an opportunity, the rare opportunity that regional Australians would have the opportunity to have their voices heard. And I don't want that to pass by no matter what the political opportunities might look like. And I think it's important that I, leading regional Australia, do the right thing, and that's why I'm prepared to go. But as two different political parties, there'll be times where we have two different perspectives on this. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing that there's diversity of ideas.
PM can now reveal Jim Chalmers has officially invited David Littleproud to the summit. In a letter shared with PM, Chalmers sought clarity on Littleproud's stance on attending the event and offered him a seat at the table. But whilst the government is busy sorting out its guest list, the Australian Council of Trade Unions has released a discussion paper outlining its vision ahead of the summit. The report argues the rapid lifting of rates risks triggering a heavy economic slowdown or even a recession, and calls for a rethink on the role of the Reserve Bank. Secretary Sally McManus.
One of the key things that it's meant to do is to work towards full employment, but yet it just focuses on the issue of interest rates. And that's a very, very blunt instrument.
Economist Jim Stanford is the report's author.
They've got one giant sledgehammer in their toolbox, which is called the national interest rate, to try and keep inflation at 2.5%. And experience has shown that the interest rate alone isn't enough. Even when the economy is weak, low interest rates don't solve every problem. And when inflation is rising like it is right now, high interest rates won't solve it alone either.
The report also advocates for a tax on companies that have made large profits as a result of inflation.
So particularly in industries like energy and supermarkets and banking and property markets, we've seen huge increases in profit. And one way to try and cool that off is to recapture some of those excess windfall profits and recycle the money towards Australians who need it to help them pay for the inflated costs of petrol and housing and other essential commodities.
The plan has been labelled radical by Shadow Treasurer Angus Taylor. In a statement provided to PM, he claimed it would send a wrecking ball through the economy. But economist Jim Stanford disagrees and says now is as good a time as ever for big ideas.
We've gone through 10 years of record-breaking wage stagnation, and now with inflation surging, real wages are falling and falling quickly. So we need to really rethink how we're managing the overall macro economy.
That's economist Jim Stanford ending Oliver Gordon's report. You're listening to PM with me, David Lipson, and you can always hear all of our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Animal welfare advocates are disappointed with today's decision by the High Court to reject their challenge to the so-called ag-gag laws in New South Wales. Those laws restrict the secret filming and broadcasting of allegedly cruel treatment of animals. But the decision is being welcomed by the peak body for meat producers, as Samantha Donovan reports.
Media reports on animal cruelty often rely on secret surveillance footage, like that aired in Four Corners' 2015 expose on Australia's greyhound industry.
Using undercover investigators and piecing together hundreds of hours of surveillance vision captured on secret cameras, we've discovered live baiting rings operating in private across the country.
Today, the High Court rejected the case of the Farm Transparency Project. It argued restricting its right to film farming practices surreptitiously and publish the results interfere with its implied right to freedom of political communication. The court upheld the position of the New South Wales government and ruled the laws are reasonable and necessary to protect the safety and privacy of farmers. The Farm Transparency Project is a non-profit animal rights organisation. Its executive director, Chris Delforce, is disappointed with the High Court's decision.
The court has chosen not to answer the key question in all of this, which is about the media's right to publish or report on matters of public interest, particularly relating to animal welfare, animal cruelty. They've really chosen to restrict their decision to individuals who have captured this footage by way of trespass, saying that those same individuals then can't go and publish or report on it. So it hasn't answered the question of whether media has that right and the broader question of whether consumers have the right to know what they're paying for when they're purchasing meat, dairy and eggs or they're attending a horse or a greyhound race.
This High Court case dealt with New South Wales laws. So how relevant is it to other states where animal cruelty may be filmed secretly?
All states have some equivalent Surveillance Devices Act, but most other states have some sort of exemptions for public interest. In South Australia, there's a specific exemption for media outlets who are doing the publishing, but there's no exceptions of that kind in New South Wales. So it's certainly the most oppressive of the state laws.
But the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, Patrick Hutchinson, is pleased with today's High Court decision.
We want to not only just protect the privacy of our members and those processes that that are our members, but also the workers that are there. When we had the last vegan interruption to our businesses, it nearly cost someone's life. So we really don't want to be seeing that happen, and that's the unintended consequences of what they've been doing. People were chaining themselves to machines, and machines that they do not understand.
The Farm Transparency Project, which took this case all the way to the High Court, says it's important, though, for consumers to be able to see how their meat, how their food is produced. Is there a risk that some cases of animal cruelty will be kept in the dark because of this ruling?
Look, we have the highest rating of animal welfare in the globe, and that has come through a huge amount of research and development, but also hard work and effort on behalf of our industry. And part of that hard work includes rooting out those that don't want to be following or working with us. So we are more than happy to root out, find out, and get rid of anyone in our industry that's not undertaking the most effective animal welfare outcomes. But I think more importantly, what this also shows us is that in a lot of circumstances, there is misinterpretation of the practices that people are looking at, and inevitably, that is then going to their ultimate aim, which is to get rid of us.
Barbara McDonald is a professor of law at the University of Sydney and has previously led an Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry into privacy. She thinks the High Court has made the right decision.
I have to say that I don't support the idea of somebody being able to breach the Surveillance Devices Act in New South Wales to trespass onto land and to record activities which are lawful. I understand the motives of the party in this case. You know, they want to stop cruelty to animals and so on. But they really want to have the right to do things which even the police can't do. The police need to get a warrant to use a listening device or surveillance device, and that's for our protection. We don't have a broad protection of privacy under our law, but we do have various bits of protection, and one of these is the Surveillance Devices Act. And I think it's important that we do protect people's privacy from unlawful attempts to see whether people are committing a crime. That would be a very dangerous precedent.
That's Professor Barbara McDonald from the University of Sydney Law School. Samantha Donovan reporting. It's a nice idea, a chicken coop in the backyard, a few chooks and fresh eggs every day for your morning omelette, but a study's found the level of lead in the eggs of chickens kept in city backyards is more than 40 times that of supermarket eggs. And as Angus Randall reports, in some cases it could pose a threat to human health.
Tim Peterson's backyard is full of powerful women, or at least their chicken namesakes.
We've got Henrietta, Hillary, Camilla and Julia.
He lives in Leichhardt in Sydney's Inner West, one of the worst places on the East Coast for soil lead contamination. That's according to a new study.
It doesn't surprise me, just given what I know about urban environments and soil qualities, especially in some of the older suburbs. But it's not something that I have to worry about because we've spent a lot of time and energy in building up the soils, had them tested so that we're confident that we don't have high lead levels.
Professor Mark Taylor is the chief environmental scientist at Victoria's EPA. He's been investigating lead levels in chickens in Sydney. So, where is the lead coming from?
Leaded gasoline or leaded petrol, about three quarters of what went into the tanks of cars came out of the tailpipe and were deposited as dust. That's accumulated in the soils, it's still there. Industry emissions, going back from old, you know, lead smelting or related activity emissions. Those emissions, they produce dust, they accumulate in the soils, and then people who've lived in older homes, particularly timber homes, would be painted, typically with lead-based paint. Those homes get renovated or it wears off. It accumulates in the soils and it doesn't go away.
His research took a peek inside 55 Sydney gardens and measured the lead levels in 69 birds and their eggs. It found almost one in two eggs contained lead levels that posed a danger to humans. And on average, the backyard eggs contained 40 times the amount of lead found in store-bought eggs. As for the chickens, Professor Mark Taylor says they may not show any signs of health trouble and are pretty resilient to lead poisoning, but it's their eggs where it causes the problem for us.
You know, there's a distinct possibility that if we're consuming lots of eggs from a location where there's high levels of lead in the soil, there is a potential risk of harm that they'd be consuming too much lead.
The World Health Organization says there's no safe level of lead exposure. It can cause a drop in IQ, cardiovascular disease, and reduce kidney function. Professor Mark Taylor has a simple message for anyone nervous about their health.
Get your soils tested and then determine whether or not you should be keeping chickens.
Author Fiona Scott Norman literally wrote the book on backyard chickens and the people who love them. She's one of the more than 400,000 Australians who keep backyard chooks. Her current flock includes Karen, Salty, Little Fatty and Duffy.
I've just moved to still an industrial area, but formerly a very industrial area, which is Melbourne's West. The reason I feel comfortable with the chickens in my garden is simply that all of the soil has been replaced in the backyard.
Demand for backyard chickens soared at the start of the pandemic. Like any trend, there's a concern about who might be jumping on the bandwagon without thinking it through. But Fiona Scott Norman believes the recent chicken owners will be able to take care of their flock.
You couldn't get a chicken for love nor money, let me tell you. They were absolutely bought out. And I was initially concerned about it. And I thought, oh my goodness, all these terrible amateur people have bought chickens and they'll be making terrible mistakes and not knowing how to look after them. But kind of anecdotally, discovered that actually the people who had panic bought chickens were people who had already been researching getting chickens. So on the whole, I'm pleased to report that the people who did buy chickens then did more or less know what they were getting themselves in for.
Professor Mark Taylor's Sydney modelling found the levels of lead in the soil were at their highest in the inner city, fading away the further into the suburbs you went. The research shows it would be a similar story in other capital cities. So, should there be restrictions on owning chickens when there's a likelihood of lead contamination? Backyard chicken owner Tim Peterson says that's not the answer.
We have bees in our backyard as well, and there's a fair bit of regulation around keeping bees. And I know that these kinds of things can be a really big barrier to people taking up beekeeping, and if they were to bring in a lot of regulation around chickens, then there's a really distinct likelihood that that would stop people doing things, and I don't know whether that's a great idea.
That's urban farmer Tim Peterson ending Angus Randall's report. Well, there's confusion in Fiji after its Reserve Bank launched a new limited edition banknote featuring Chinese wealth and fortune imagery. The 88-cent note has been issued as a collector's item, causing a stir in the Pacific nation at a time of growing geopolitical tension over China's regional influence. Dubravka Volada reports.
The yellow and orange coloured 88-cent note features the Chinese god of wealth and a money tree in Chinese customs.
The Reserve Bank of Fiji is proud to introduce a new numismatic 88-cent banknote.
But the limited edition note is sparking controversy, with some Fijians questioning why it features Chinese iconography. The leader of the National Federation Party, Biman Prasad, says the bewilderment is understandable.
Normally, commemorative coins and notes are normally produced to mark commemorative events of both national and sometimes international significance. So what does it commemorate?
He says the timing of the launch is somewhat odd.
The Reserve Bank has said clearly, and it seems to me, that it is designed to raise funds for the Reserve Bank. That's a bit odd at this point in time, when the Reserve Bank should be really concerned about other issues, you know, particularly inflation, you know, high cost of living.
And the Fijian community in Australia is also divided. As a collector based in Melbourne, Naisal Tendraki says it's an issue that's dividing the community.
It's very polarising, I think. Avid collectors like myself will probably, you know, buy it up. But for me personally, you know, that as Fijians, we should embrace it because, you know, we have a very vibrant and diverse Chinese community in Fiji, and I think it's a good way to celebrate.
But what significance has the god of wealth in Chinese culture? Here's Air News professor of finance, Mei Jin Chiang.
Like many religion in culture, people like to put certain, you know, symbolic things, like using the god of wealth to, you know, in the house, hoping it brings fortune.
In a statement, the Reserve Bank of Fiji says it will not enter circulation and is intended as a collector's piece and as a means to generate money. The Chinese diaspora in Fiji is small, with most recent estimates suggesting there are about 8,000 people with Chinese origin in the country. That's about 1% of the total population. Professor Mei-Jin Chiang says she believes the issue is being politicized too much.
Printing a money note in 88, which is not convenient for transaction, in my opinion, is just much more symbolic.
But Biman Prasad says it does raise some questions.
You know, if something like this has been issued in the context of the geopolitics, then it does create some kind of suspicion and controversy.
That's Fijian MP Biman Prasad, ending Dubravka Volita's report. And that's the program for today. Thanks for joining me. I'm David Lipson. Up next, the Religion and Ethics Report with Stan Grant.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The Reserve Bank has spent most of the year furiously increasing interest rates. Now the big banks are betting they'll start falling again soon. It's not due to an improving economic outlook, but because we could end up in a recession. Today, the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder, on the miserable state of the economy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.